From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Happy St. Paddy's Day, by the way, to those of you. And next hour, in the spirit of St. Paddy's Day, we'll discuss the magic of leprechauns. But here's what's happening. Officials in Malaysia say they believe the co-pilot of missing flight MH370 spoke the last words to ground controllers before it simply vanished. Investigators are looking into the possibility that the aircraft's crew were involved in this disappearance. The search for the plane has extended into two vast air corridors. 26 countries have been asked to help find the jet, which went missing over a week ago with 239 people on board. Now, as I mentioned, they are looking for this plane toward two vast corridors. After the pilot apparently went to the west, he could have gone into either direction. Before they announced those two corridors, remote viewer Ed Dames contacted our producer Tom Danheiser and gave him a map. That map is illustrated at coasttocoastam.com in the highlight reel. This map is uncanny and is very close to the two air corridors that experts are now saying they believe the plane may have gone. Let's check in with Major Ed Dames. Ed, you did a remote viewing on this, and I've got to tell you, it is frighteningly similar to what we've just been given.
Well, that was a result of some specialized techniques that only professionals are aware of in my business. And this is almost like deja vu in terms of Coast to Coast and the Steve Fossett case.
Oh, that's right.
Air Flight 990, where I recreated what happened on that flight. So you know, here we go again.
When you and your crew started working on this, obviously, again, it was days before this release of these two air corridors. Do you believe the plane has landed somewhere or it's in one of the ocean bodies?
George, it was an act of piracy on the part of Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah. His planned destination was Mogadishu, Somalia. It wasn't a suicide agenda like Flight 990, and his co-pilot was oblivious to Shah's plan. And I'd like to say something. I'd like for First Officer Farid Hamid's fiance and his family to know that he died a hero. He was in the co-pilot seat until the end. He locked Captain Shah outside, probably after a violent struggle, but he couldn't manage to regain control of the airplane because he was physiologically incapacitated, as were all the dying members of the crew. They suffered. The plane went through an extreme, rapid, uncontrolled decompression. So both the crew and the passengers suffered crippling hypoxia and probably hypothermia. And as much as he tried after a struggle, a probable struggle, Hamid couldn't regain control of the plane.
Ed, we'll be checking in with you throughout the week. Top Israeli officials, defense officials, say that they have put in place a confidential list of security measures in light of the baffling disappearance of this plane. Experts fear that it could become a weapon of mass destruction if in the wrong hands. Now, with no trace of this flight after 9 days, one of several theories has emerged is that the plane was hijacked to Iran, where it could be turned into a massive and devastating weapon. Two Iranian passengers are known to have been aboard, traveling on false passports. While Israeli officials did not confirm any suspicious activity here regarding Iran, experts said it is not a stretch to point the finger at Israel's Middle East nemesis. In a moment, Whitley Strieber will join us as we will talk more about this situation. And then later this hour, a pilot, a confidential pilot, we'll talk about this case. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree recognizing Crimea as a sovereign state, paving the way for it to be absorbed into Russia. Well, I was jolted this morning, as many others were in the Los Angeles area, by a magnitude 4.4 earthquake near LA. Not a lot of damage, but is it a prelude to something bigger? Cal Ori, the author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. Cal, what do you think? We just talked about this a week ago.
Yeah, it reminds me, it reminds me back of 2005 in June, mid-June, we had this four quakes, two in Northern California offshore, just like last week when I was on, and two in Southern California, but they were stronger. I made a forecast, which was published in January 2014, that at least one major shaker would happen on the West Coast, whether it be in Alaska, offshore Northern California, which we met last week, the 6.8, it was downgraded, the Bay Area and or Greater Los Angeles. So I was pleasantly surprised this morning when I saw that. They did downgrade it from a 4.7 to 4.4. Mm-hmm. And then today I read that a geophysics professor at Stanford in Palo Alto, he's actually predicting a quake for Los Angeles in 2014 before June. So I didn't know that. I mean, as an intuitive and a quake sensitive, I just tossed out my predictions. But now he's saying it along with other scientists. So we're definitely overdue. I think the seismic drought is almost over, and be prepared is all I can say.
Just what we need, Cal. Thank you so much. Winter's still not over in the mid-Atlantic states. 7 to 8 inches of snow. Washington, D.C., pelted with its worst March snowstorm in a long, long time. When does it let up? Television pitchman Kevin Trudeau, who was convicted last year of criminal contempt for exaggerating the contents of his weight loss book in infomercials, has now been sentenced to 10 years in prison. The 51-year-old Trudeau, who has been held in federal custody since his conviction in November, will also have 5 years of supervised release after serving his court orders over the years. Trudeau was found guilty last November of violating a 2004 federal court settlement with the FTC that barred him from misrepresenting the contents of his books and advertisements. Some say it's a witch hunt. Some say it's the government's way of trying to silence Trudeau because of his alternative medical practices. The judge says no. Swapping butter for a sunflower spread may not lower heart risk after all, according to a British study. Contrary to guidance, there is no evidence that changing the type of fat you eat from bad saturated to healthier polyunsaturated cuts the heart risk. But they do say dark chocolate helps. As a matter of fact, there's a study underway to see if chocolate pills will help you in the heart. So we'll keep an ear and eye on that one. Loren Scott, a noted fashion designer who had been the Rolling Stones Mick Jagger's companion for more than a decade, found dead in her New York apartment of an apparent suicide. She was 49 years old. They found her hanging from a doorknob with a scarf around her neck. Implant pioneer and dear friend Dr. Roger Lear has passed away. After a long illness, he was 80 years old, survived by his wife and daughter. He, of course, was the author of The Aliens and the Scalpel, The UFO Crash in Brazil, Casebook Alien Implants, and others. Dr. Lear dramatically advanced research into physical evidence of the close encounter experience. Along with his surgical team, he has performed 17 surgeries on alleged alien abductees. He was a frequent guest on Coast to Coast.
Before we do the surgery, we want to make sure the thing is there and it's where it was, you know, when I first see it. So I take an x-ray right before I do the surgery. And unfortunately, this thing had worked its way up into a joint and had fractured into three pieces. So I said, oh. Boy, when it's in three pieces, it's going to be harder to get out when it's just one. But we had, as I said, we got enough funds to be able to get the equipment so that makes these things feasible to do. But I got it out, and it was all in one sack. It was in one subcutaneous, strange sack, which it's still in.
We will miss Dr. Roger Lear. Now, there is an issue, however. The family is having difficulty raising enough funds to bury him. And we need your help. At coasttocoastam.com, you'll see a link to the website of Dr. Roger Lear. There is a little fundraiser going on. Jason Martell, one of those who put this together. Jason, of course, a leading researcher into ancient advanced technologies. Jason, first of all, I want to say hello to you and thank you for this effort.
Of course, George. How are you doing? I wish this was under better circumstances.
Oh, he will be missed. I was just with him at a conference a few months ago.
He's such a trooper.
Oh, he really was. You know, I would tell this special joke about him, and he just always laughed so hard he almost cried every time we did that. But tell us about the fundraiser, and what do you need, Jason?
Right. Well, you know, as you mentioned, the family, you know, as a lot of people have these circumstances, weren't expecting this and are under some financial duress to properly put Dr. Lear to rest. So if anyone can contribute 5, 10, 100, you know, 1,000, 10,000, whatever is acceptable to you that you can contribute to the Dr. Lear Fund, you can go to alienscalpel.com. That's Dr. Lear's site. alienscalpel.com, and just click the donate button and just give whatever you can that's appropriate. It'll definitely help this pioneer that we will always remember as a legacy in ufology.
Jason, if the family does get enough funds, what are they going to do?
Well, they're just wanting to bury him properly, essentially. You know, it's unfortunately in our U.S. today to bury someone in a nice casket and to have a service. These things are several thousand dollars, so the family is asking for help just to cover that service alone.
Okay, thank you so much, Jason. And we've got that link, as I mentioned, at coasttocoastam.com. Next Friday, by this coming Friday, we will have a special tribute, by the way, to the life of Dr. Roger Lear with a number of noted coast-to-coast guests. And in a moment, Whitley Strieber joins us. He'll be talking about this incredible story of this missing plane, one of Whitley's books, of course, Critical Mass. He knows what he's talking about, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, of course, Whitley Strieber, well-known author and talk show host in his own right, and heads up, of course, unknowncountry.com with his wife, Anne, who is doing remarkably well from her medical condition. As a matter of fact, they have written a book about her life called Miraculous Journey, which is available at Amazon, where ebooks are sold. That's an amazing story, Whitley, all by itself.
Oh, it sure is, George. She was supposed to have passed on by now, and she's thriving.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's the best news. Whitley, we've only got about 9 minutes. I want to get into this plane, but very quickly, I would like you to say something about your dear friend, Roger Lear.
Okay, well, of course, he was a dear friend. I was at his first implant removal, and I stayed with him for all those years. I introduced him to Dr. William Mallow at Southwest Research Institute, who did a lot of research on his implants. And I have to say, this man was an incredible pioneer, a wonderful man. And the fact that his family can't even afford to bury him. It's just shocking because we live in this culture of denial. He did everything the skeptics said they needed. He proved it completely. And what was the result? Silence. Silence. Awful. What a life he lived. What a great man. A great man has died. And he matters. He matters immensely. What he did will, in the end, change the direction this species goes in, but not yet. Not yet, because we're not ready, apparently. I was ready, and I think most of the listeners are ready. So go to that website, alienscalpel.com. Help a poor guy get put under the ground.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whitley, this plane situation is absolutely bizarre. And you sent me a note several days ago, and I think you may have hit it on the head in terms of why the pilot went up to 40, 45,000 feet.
Oh, yeah. He went up to 40. There's only here. Let me outline this. First of all, no commercial airliner has been missing this long in history.
Ever.
Now, here's the sequence, and here are the questions, and here's what we know that the experts won't quite say because they're experts. But I'm just a guy who wrote a book about nuclear terrorism, so I can talk. All right. First of all, question number one. This airplane apparently passed over Malaysian airspace as an unknown flight that had it had dropped. Well, let me go back a second. It drops off. It drops its transponder offline. No one, not Vietnamese ATC, not Malaysian ATC, makes any attempt to contact it. Then it makes a turn. It, as now, as an unknown plane, off course, it flies across northern Malaysia. And all they get are a couple of vague radar blips when it's already out to sea on the other side of the country. What did they have, corpses at the radar screens? What were they doing? Those are two huge questions. Now, we get on to the larger question. Here's the sequence. Shortly after that, the plane climbs to 45,000 feet. In the cockpit of a 777, you can turn off the compressors that keep the cabin at a breathable altitude.
That's right.
That plane was up there long enough to have killed every single person on board. Now, the pilots have, the passengers have oxygen that lasts maybe 15 minutes. The crew, cabin crew has oxygen that lasts about a little longer, maybe 30 minutes at a stretch. The pilots have about the same amount, but if there was only one person alive in the cabin, he would have had a full hour. About an hour after the plane reaches 45,000 feet, it crash dives to 23,000 feet, just below the altitude you need to be if you don't have any oxygen equipment in order to live. And at that point, he was turning, apparently, the compressors back on again and repressurizing the cabin after he was sure everyone else was dead. That's what I think happened.
I mean, that pilot could very well be one of the world's biggest mass murderers.
Oh, no question. And there's only one reason to do that. You're not going to crash the plane into the sea. But why do that if you're going to crash the plane into the sea?
Good point.
You took it somewhere. Now, where would you take it? We already have two countries that ignored its passage. The first one that ignored what is in aviation a major emergency incident, the disappearance of a transponder. The other country ignored not only that, but also the passage of the plane through their airspace when they must have known there was an airplane on the loose out there somewhere. Something was terribly wrong. Now, the plane simply disappears. The Indians, the Chinese, the Pakistanis all say they never saw it. Now, that's possible because it is possible to fly these planes in such a way that if you know what you're doing, you can get past through radar.
Oh, sure. And he came down low enough.
Oh, yeah. He could have done that. Now, if there's one real rogue country he could have missed, it's Turkmenistan. It could have reached. It's Turkmenistan. Now, if the plane reached someplace like that, conceivably, there are parts of Afghanistan that the United States has not really got covered anymore. There are other areas up there that it could have been, or he could have surprised everybody and crossed the Indian Ocean and gone to Sudan or even Yemen. This is an airplane with a really, really long range. We're already looking at a situation where the plane was mysteriously ignored by the Malaysian military, the pilot, who knows how much fuel was actually aboard? We don't know that.
Whitley, we're going to take this break. I'm going to keep you for a few minutes between the breaks, so you just stay with us, Whitley Strieber with us, because I want to ask you what you think the purpose of keeping this plane might be. I'm George Norrie. We're going to be back in a moment with Whitley Strieber. Later on this hour, a pilot who remains confidential and anonymous, he will join us as well. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're going to keep Whitley Strieber for a moment before we join Charlie, a pilot, an anonymous pilot. Whitley, you, of course, wrote the book Critical Mass about nuclear terrorism.
Yes.
You and I both agree this plane is probably on the ground somewhere. Do you think it is being readied as a nuke missile and it's going to crash into some city somewhere?
Well, let's put it this way. Israel is on a high level of alert about this, and with good reason. The United States military's Northern Command is not on a high level of alert yet, but they are certainly watching the situation. If this airplane, a big airplane like that, was loaded with, not even with a nuclear bomb, although that could be done, but with nuclear material and high explosives, it could take out a city. If it was loaded with a nuclear bomb, it could be a real catastrophe. And what's so disturbing is a big plane like that is capable of carrying something quite heavy, a bomb, a primitive bomb. Primitive bombs are heavy. They're big and heavy. And so I think it's a time when everyone, every country on this planet, including Europe, the United States, Israel, every country that might be a target, needs to be extremely careful. Now, that said, I have one more thing to add, which is, in the past, there have been three instances where aircraft have disappeared under mysterious circumstances that are UFO-related. Kinross Air Force, the Kinross Air Force Base incident in 1953, and two incidents in 1978, the Puerto Rico incident and the Valentich case in Australia. We have on tonight on Unknown Country for Coast listeners the audio tape of the actual Mayday call from the 1978 Puerto Rico incident.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Great.
Now, I don't know if this is an anomalous incident. Frankly, I don't think so. What I think it is either this pilot, it took this plane into the southern Indian Ocean in order to make it disappear, in order to cause the absolute maximum suffering to the families involved, or he has landed it somewhere full of dead bodies, they've been taken off, and it's going to turn out to be a flying bomb that's going to show up somewhere one day. That's my real worry.
We shall track this. Whitley, thank you so much. And up next, we will be talking with Charlie, currently a pilot for a major airline. We will not disclose who he is. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We are going to bring you Charlie. Charlie is currently a pilot for a major airline. Obviously, we are not going to reveal who he is or the airline he works for. But he has experience in flying major jets, and we want to get his reaction to this still incredible story. Charlie, thank you for spending some time with us.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Boeing 777?
Yes, I can. The Boeing 777 was Boeing's first digital fly-by-wire airplane. And what that means, fly-by-wire means that there's no physical connection between the flight controls that the pilot uses to manipulate the airplane and the actual actuators that move the flight controls. What happens is that when an actuator, when a command is put in by the yoke or by the rudder pedals, it sends an electronic signal to, in the case of the 777, one of three flight control computers. Now, these flight control computers are very robust. They have two channels. They're all powered from a different power source, and they send their signal out to the and why this becomes important, I will tell you in a minute. But they send the signals out to the control surfaces. The control surfaces move, and the airplane does what it's supposed to do. Now, why this is important in this case is because many people have speculated that the airplane lost all power and that's why the transponder went off. And when you lose all power on the 777, all power, meaning that all power to the point where the transponder wouldn't work, because the transponder would always work on the last bus that was available that would be powered by the batteries if everything else was lost. If you lose all power, you cannot fly, physically fly the airplane. There's no backup system that would... Now, there's an analog fly-by-wire system that basically translates the direct... that bypasses the flight control computers, but it still needs electrical power to operate. So without electrical power to operate, that plane is impossible to fly. And it would eventually become unstable, I believe, and become unstable and crash.
Over the last hour or two, Charlie, there's been reports that the computer was programmed to force that movement to the west where that plane was going, but it could only have been programmed by somebody from within that plane. Can you tell us about that?
That's a different computer. That's the flight control computer.
Okay.
That computer is basically where you load the flight plan, your route of flight, and obviously on a long flight, you don't fly manually. That flight path is hooked up to the autopilot. Of course, this airplane actually has three different autopilots, so it's hooked up to the autopilot. The autopilot basically flies that route. Now, you could fly that route manually as the pilot also, but in order for that route to get into the flight control computer, you would have the wrong route, the route that they ended up taking after the plane was taken over. You'd have to program it. Somebody would have to program those points. And I want to add one other thing that I haven't seen anywhere, and I'm not 100% sure this is on the Boeing 777, but it's on the airplane that I fly, which is also a fly-by-wire airplane.
Okay.
When you turn off the transponder, you get a warning message. During flight, you get a warning message on a screen in the cockpit, a ding and a warning message that tells you that the transponder is not operating. So what this tells me is that if one of the pilots turned the transponder off and the other pilot was aware, in other words, he was still conscious, the other pilot would have seen it too, which would have drawn their suspicion. So my theory now is that one of the two pilots probably put something in the coffee or the drink of the other pilots that was slow acting enough that they could operate the airplane up to cruise, and by then they had passed out.
Passed out.
And I do have a hard time seeing their motives. Either of these two guys' motives, it's very hard for me to see it unless they led double lives.
Now, in this particular case, too, all these maneuvers and everything we've heard to date, going up 45,000 feet, down to 3,000, 5,000 feet, to me is not indicative of a pilot who's going to take this jet, just like the Egyptian pilot did, and ram it into the ocean.
I agree 100%. A suicidal pilot, unless he's a very wishy-washy suicidal pilot, is going to point the airplane at the water because they were mostly over water early in the flight.
And go for it.
And go for it. And have it over with, and that'll be the end of it. So I don't see that scenario either. There's two scenarios I see. Either the plane was taken over, or you had a zombie airplane.
And what do you mean by a zombie airplane?
A zombie airplane. The pilots are dead, and it's just flying on its own.
Ah.
But in order for that to happen, the pilots would have to be overcome. I see no scenario where that happens without the plane being damaged so much that it's unflyable. And I'll tell you why. Because I've had some instances in my flying career where there have been fumes, electrical fumes in the cockpit from something that was electrically burning or whatever you want to call it. And I've had to declare an emergency. The last time it happened, I had to declare an emergency. The thing about an airplane is about 80% of the air is recirculated. 20% is new air, 80% is recirculated. Well, what happens when you recirculate air? The odor, whatever odor it is, if it's acrid, it goes everywhere and you smell it very fast. You smell the odor before you see smoke.
That's right.
So the protocol is if you smell these fumes, you immediately put on your oxygen mask. So if you put on your oxygen mask, that prevents you from being overcome by any future smoke. So say there was a fire in the aircraft, or a smoke in the aircraft, a fire would probably take down the airplane. If there's smoke, they also immediately start to descend and try to find the nearest suitable airport to land. They're on oxygen. The first thing they're going to do is call air traffic control.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was just no response after that good night.
There was nothing. And the transponder was off. You're not going to turn the transponder off if you have a smoke in the cockpit. You're just not going to do it. Now, I do have one other interesting little, what's the word I'm looking for?
Tidbit
on this theory. Maybe there was somebody involved in the back. Now, breaching the cockpit's almost impossible. The flight attendants are trained to protect that cockpit with their lives, literally. So for somebody to try to breach the cockpit in this day and age, I don't see that happening. But what could happen, perhaps, maybe somebody in the back had a little two-way radio with the other pilot. He said, hey, come up and use the forward laboratory, because there's usually a forward laboratory very close to the cockpit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The guy goes in the forward lab. They communicate and say, hey, as soon as I'm going to count to three, as soon as you come out of that laboratory, I'm going to open the cockpit door so you can come in. The flight attendants would have no way of knowing that this was pre-arranged.
That's right.
And the other guy could get in. So, and then, of course, what you do is you climb up, you depressurize the airplane, asphyxiate everybody. I'd be very surprised that airplane could get up to 45,000 feet as heavy as it was. Very, very surprised. There's no way that could happen in the scenario of the pilots being incapacitated.
Why are they saying they think it went up that high?
Because the radar traces from the Malaysian military seem to indicate that. That's where they're getting this altitude information from what I understand. So if it did go up that high, it wasn't up there very long, because the plane it's above its service ceiling. The plane had a full load of fuel, so it'd be almost impossible for it to get up that high that early in the flight. But if it did, it wasn't up there very long. But maybe that was the plan: get it up there, and then just to asphyxiate the passengers, and then bring it back down.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think, Charlie, that this plane is on the ground somewhere. Maybe hidden in Somalia.
I think it's on the ground somewhere. It probably landed somewhere first at a predestined location where they had fuel waiting. They might have had fuel waiting for this plane for months, so to avoid there being suspicion. I think that because of everybody thought it crashed. They're looking for it, so nobody's actually looking for the plane. So they would have an opportunity at night to refuel it and then take it wherever they want it after they refueled it. Again, it'd have to be under surreptitious means, out of radar environment. But, okay, and then once it lands, you're in a totally different part of the world that nobody's looking for it. I personally believe right now the U.S. government's putting out the information that we're getting on the media is misinformation, because we're trying to make those guys feel comfortable so that they maybe poke their heads up and we can get a better idea where they're at.
Well, knowing the mind of a terrorist, they generally want credit for things that they do. The reason why they don't in this case is because the job's not done yet.
Exactly. You wouldn't take credit for something when you've got this. This is just the beginning of the nefarious plot as you were saying earlier, use the airplane as a weapon.
That's
whether
exactly.
It be a, now, it's not going to be that easy to do that. Getting through I have some ways that they could try, some ideas of ways they could try, but it's not going to be that easy for them to do that. But that doesn't mean they won't try.
I don't think a country like Iran is doing this only because they don't need to steal a jet. They have them.
Right.
So this is an organization or a group that couldn't afford to buy one. They couldn't afford to get one. They
had to do it. You could lease an airplane on the open market, but you have a hard time leasing a 777.
Yeah, exactly. I'm told there are a couple used ones for sale.
Well, if you go on Airplane Trader, the Airplane Trader magazine, there's all sorts of commercial airplanes for sale all the time.
Charlie, I would guess that this episode is the talk amongst all you pilots right now.
It is. It's the talk among the pilots, among the passengers. It's really kind of a national obsession, and rightfully so, because you couldn't write a mystery more convoluted and complicated and ghoulish, creepy than this, and yet it seems to be happening right before our eyes.
Charlie, I don't know what your schedule is, but I have a bank of phone calls. Can you stay one more hour, or is your time not permitting that?
I can stay maybe a half an hour longer. I'll do my best. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, we'll keep you at least for another half hour, and if you can stay the rest, that'll be great. In this entire episode, have you ever in your career ever heard of anything like this?
I have not. I've heard of electrical problems that could cause certain things to happen, but never a total electrical failure. A transponder would always be powered. Even if you're troubleshooting buses, a transponder would always be powered. And if for some reason the transponder wasn't going to be powered, you would tell air traffic control, hey, first of all, they would know, because you would have declared an emergency already, and then you tell them, hey, look, our transponder is going to be off for a bit. We just wanted to let you know. So, no, to answer your question, no, I cannot see any. I've never heard of anything like this.
The pilot had a simulator at home. I would guess if they can get to it and look at some of the things that he was doing, it might be very similar to what actually happened.
That's an interesting question, because, in fact, I was talking to my daughter about this earlier today. I'm sure that if he did this in a simulator and he practiced, and of course, that's a great way to practice, believe me, you
sure
can practice it over and over again. I'm sure that he erased all of that information, but as my daughter adequately pointed out, erasing doesn't really mean erasing, and these people are pretty good at going in and looking at data that was supposedly erased. So we'll have to see. But yeah, that's absolutely true. He could have practiced it over and over again. The thing is, that guy seemed to have no motive.
No.
He seemed like a really great guy and really dedicated to his profession. I'm trying to. Maybe there were one of these two pilots was leading a double life.
Maybe. Or maybe they threatened him. You know, either you do this or everybody you know is gone.
Even then, I can't get to this happening.
No.
I just can't get to that happening.
All right, Charlie, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with you. Promise calls from you Coast to Coast listeners. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.